live in a high-tech world where calculators can do a lot of our math, and spell check can take the guesswork out of our spelling, and your word processing software can improve your grammar without you even knowing it. But we still have to know how to read. Did you have trouble learning to read? Or are there kids in your family that are struggling today with this essential skill? When I was growing up, someone wrote a bestseller, Why Johnny Can't Read, that struck a nerve and overnight became a catchphrase. Well, a lot has happened in the 40 or 50 years since then. And where do we stand now? According to the National Center for Education Statistics, approximately 40% of bright, capable children have trouble learning to read. Two systems dominate reading instruction. First, there's phonics, which teaches the sounds of words. And then a little less influential, but still out there, is hold language, which emphasizes books and stories. And the battles between the two systems have been fierce enough to be referred to as the reading wars. Well, today's guest, Dr. Marion Blank, says that while both phonics and whole language may be vital, they're not enough. Even combined, they overlook a range of skills that are essential to effective reading and writing. And she proposes quite a different approach. As you may know, I'm always on the lookout for solutions, and so I've invited Dr. Blank to shed light on what probably remains a mysterious world of brain science, teaching methods, and bureaucracy. Marion Blank, Ph.D., is an accomplished children's therapist with over 30 years of practical experience helping children with reading and learning challenges. And in addition to producing books, articles, tests, software programs, she's currently the director of a Light on Literacy program at Columbia University in New York City. And she serves as a consultant to a wide range of school districts in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Her latest book, The Reading Remedy, and her new reading system, Phonics Plus 5, now hope to make her ideas available to every parent. Welcome, Marion Blank.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So tell us a bit about your path to the work that you're doing today. How did you focus on reading? And then how did you end up coming up with your own methods?
That's a good question. It's hard to think back, except I remember even as a young child, I was just fascinated with language. And I used to listen to programs on the radio that would discuss language, even when I was about 9 or 10 years of age.
You know, I'll just tell you that when I asked Deborah Tannen, the linguist, the same thing, she said the same thing. As a child, it was just the thing that fascinated her the most.
And I guess, as with most skills that you have, it really rests with your own skill base. And one of my, I don't know if you call it talents, is I'm very tuned into voices. So, for example, I never forget a voice. People will call me whom I haven't heard from in 20 years, and they say, you'll never know who this is. And I say, of course I know who this is. And I'm much better at recognizing voices even than faces. So it's clearly was something that I was born with, I think. But then I worked for many years with someone, a psychiatrist, Wagner Bridger, at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and he was fascinated with language. And we began a whole series of studies on language, but they were basic research on how people process it, how it affects the way you perceive material. And in the course of the work, I began seeing lots and lots of children who had a range of language problems. And at the time when I started, it was really interesting. They never even thought of reading as a language problem. It was considered a visual problem only, if you had any problem, because it was most children who have trouble reading still can talk quite well. So they said, well, it's not a language issue. It's a visual issue of some sort. And that was the famous work of Orton and so on. And I began doing work which showed that reading problems were really based on subtle language problems. And from there, I went into a variety of language issues, both spoken language problems and written language problems in a whole range of children, including now, for example, I do a lot of work with autistic children. And my goal is like yours, to make things better.
Yep. And so that's why you've actually ended up pioneering your own things.
Right.
Let's review, just as a setup, the battle that I spoke about between phonics and whole language over the years. I mean, it seems like, you know, one is up and then I think actually I'm going to lead right into part of your answer, which is one of up, and then we find out that isn't quite working.
Yeah.
And then the other one is now the favorite, but that isn't quite working.
It's really amazing if you look at the teaching of reading over thousands of years. There's really never been a systematic way of teaching reading. The phonics started really with the Romans, or possibly the Greeks, I don't know. But certainly the Romans had books on it. And it was sort of like, well, the thing about reading is you got to put words onto pictures, onto images. And so the whole thing was, how do you the word is decoding. How do you look at the print and decode it? How do you transform those little symbols into words? And phonics was the only thing that was ever talked about. Then, in the 1930s, when Gestalt psychology became big, people said, no, people don't process individual letters, which is absolutely true. They process whole words, so let's just teach by whole words. But they never actually taught by whole words. They just showed the kids a lot of whole words. And then that failed terribly. So there was a book out by a professor at Harvard called her name was Jean Chawl, and she said, well, there's this big debate. Phonics clearly wins out over whole word. But there was nothing ever, there was nothing else thought about. Then, because we don't think very much about the past, came the, whatever, the 70s, maybe it was the 80s, people said, oh, well, we've got to do it as whole language. In other words, just throw the whole book at the child. They say children learn to speak without anybody doing anything about it. So if you just give them good books, they'll learn to read without anybody doing anything about it, which is bizarre when you think about it. And it doesn't work. And it failed worse than phonics. In other words, phonics has had a high failure rate.
Let me say that one of the things that I actually do outside of this radio station is I teach people communication strategies and so on. And one of the biggest things I talk about is storytelling and the power of telling stories, that it's the most powerful communications tool we have. And I actually go so far as to say, if you, once a child has some language and you tell them stories, they'll begin to tell stories. They will tell their stories back to you. They'll tell them to their imaginary friends, to their stuffed animals, to their pets. But you're saying for someone to try to take the leap that their ability to do that means that the same thing would work with reading is a bit of a reach.
Yes, a big reach, because you have to have a good system for easily translating those visual symbols. And whole language did nothing about it. The whole language was a set of beliefs. It was never a system.
An ideology, yes.
Yeah.
Here we go again.
Yeah.
Seems to get us into a lot of trouble.
Yes, it does.
So, in other words, basically what I was kind of alluding to when I asked the question is they've both failed.
Yes.
Basically, it all seems to fail. Now, let me ask another question about the historical context, and then we'll get into your methods. And that is, did it fail worse in the 30s? Did it fail worse in America? You know, what's the reality on this?
Unfortunately, no one has the right answer to that or the real answer. When the book was written, Why Johnny Can't Read, he claimed that no one ever failed in reading, and it's only failing now because of whole word at the time. And there was just no data on that. And I remember when I first started in the field and I was consulting in Texas, most of the Mexican immigrant children, for example, left school by second grade at that time. No one talked about it. So what happened is children who were having difficulty in school and so on there were no records kept. So, but we do know for at least the last 20 years that the failure rate has been hovering around 40% nationwide.
And when you say failure, and the way I read the piece of information was that even bright, capable children have difficulty learning to read. Mm-hmm. Is that considered failure?
It depends on how long the difficulties last. And in general, the difficulties last. That's the problem. In other words, it's generally been shown that if a child is not reading smoothly by the end of, well, certainly by the beginning of third grade, the chances of that child ever reading smoothly, really smoothly and easily, is very low.
Wow. Okay, so we've set up some of the context here, and that number that we just talked about, 40% mm-hmm. having difficulty, and so maybe going to have difficulty for the rest of their life, or just never going to, as you say, read smoothly. Do we know whether that's worse, better, the same as always?
We just don't know that. And people go back and forth. And that's, at this point, I think, a sort of wasted argument, because we are facing a huge crisis. And there are lots of other figures that go along with it. For example, the average high school graduate. Now, we're not talking about very high numbers drop out before graduation. The average high school graduate can only read at about fifth to sixth grade level. The average high school graduate cannot write a sentence at fifth grade level. And so the...
kind of a misnomer then, isn't it?
Yes.
That fifth grade level stuff.
Well, it's become...
yeah.
The levels are extraordinarily
low. That's funny.
Low.
We say, you know, 60 is the new 40. And what is this like? You know, a high school diploma is the new fifth grade?
Yeah.
Scary. So, okay, so that's kind of... that's the situation. That's... we won't argue about the why. But you say that phonics and whole language combined still leave out skills, and mm-hmm. and I think we're getting to the root of some of what you see differently in the fact that, as you said, it's a language, not just a visual issue. What are some of the skills that you feel are essential to reading, and which ones are accounted for in phonics or whole learning, and what's left out?
That's a great question, because one of the advantages I've had is that my background has been strongly in linguistics, whereas most people in psychology or in reading have not focused on that. And in linguistics, the typical set of dimensions that are used if you're evaluating a language problem is, first of all, you evaluate the perceptual skills that are. So, for example, if a child isn't speaking, the first thing somebody will do is give him a hearing test. Are they hearing? That kind of thing is never done in reading. It's just assumed all those things are in place, but they are. So, for example, one of the key skills in terms of sensory motor skills that a child needs is the visual realm. And people say, well, kids see everything. Why do they need to? We don't need to worry about whether they see the printed word. But in fact, one of the interesting things, and it's been totally neglected, is that reading is the only skill ever in our life which requires left-to-right sequencing. So that, for example, if you look at a bear and a goat and a cow, and you say, what are those? You say, a bunch of animals. And then you move them around, and you now have the goat and the bear and the cow in different directions. You say, what are those? You say, of course, there's still a bunch of animals. But you take a word like T-O-P, and you say, what is that? You say, it's top. And you say, okay, let me rearrange them to P-O-T, and you say, it's pot. You say, well, but they're the same letters. And the interesting thing is that left-to-right sequencing, everyone knows that it causes some difficulty. But people say, well, the kids will grow into it. We don't have to worry about it, which is totally wrong. The children really need attention to that. And in particular, they need attention to visual memory, the actual ability to hold those sequences in mind, which never occurs in any area but reading.
Okay, so when you said they need that, do you mean that those who are having trouble? In other words, there are some people that, you know, reading's easy.
Yeah.
I'll confess to me it was easy.
Yes.
So those who are having trouble, then what you're saying is if someone's having trouble, and now we figure at least 40% are,
yeah,
so that's 2 out of every 5 kids sitting in a classroom, mm-hmm, then you would say, let's break this down a bit.
Yes.
And let's find out if the problem's physical or this and that. So you then would do some tests.
That's right.
On this left-to-right sequencing, and you'd find that with some of them, that wasn't the problem. It's
exactly
something else. But those that it is, now that they need actually practice in mastering a physical skill.
Exactly. You've got it. And that's how Phonics Plus 5 is designed. In other words, at every point, the testing is minimal. The whole testing is 15 minutes for the whole program. It isn't hours and hours of testing. And if a child has a skill, you say, fine, we're not going to teach it. Let's move on to the next step. Everything is programmed. But if the children do need it, you can teach it. And one of the nice things is that skill can be taught easily within 4 to 6 weeks.
Now, when you say 4 to 6 weeks, if I'm a parent listening,
yes,
on the air, I go, well, 4 to 6 weeks? When am I going to find the 4 to 6 weeks to help my kid learn visual sequencing? And yet you say that's just a little. Is it that basically, let's put this in context here, if you find that's the kid's problem,
mm-hmm,
and you skip it, you'll have a lifetime of dealing with that problem. If you're saying that if you focus on it for 4 to 6 weeks, master that, now the other steps become easier.
Absolutely, but it isn't, when you say 4 to 6 weeks, it's only like 10 minutes a day.
Ah, okay.
It isn't like the child's in a booth for hours,
yeah,
and hours. 10 minutes a day.
Although that might be nice, you,
yeah,
know, some of these hyperactive ones, but basically you're saying 10 minutes a day.
That's
for,
right,
4 to 6 weeks.
Yes.
What you mean is that the part that we're going to do in teaching Johnny to read right now is first we're going to master that.
That's right.
Okay.
And
What's another?
But I wanted to address your point about parents. One of the things that has impressed me so much about parents is they are totally committed to having their children learn to read. That is probably the most motivated group of people I've ever worked with. The thing is, they've never had the right things to use. So if a child has a reading problem, they go to the school and they're told, we'll hire a tutor or buy this particular program, but it doesn't work. But if you say to parents, you have to put in about 20 minutes a day, and they see within 4 to 6 weeks tremendous improvement, many, many, in fact, most parents will do it. They are very busy now. It's hard, but they do it because they're so committed.
Okay.
But what are some of the other skills? Well,
right. So the first thing was the left-to-right visual sequencing. In other words, we just don't go left-to-right. We do other things more right to left?
No.
We just don't do that.
We don't do, see, sure, in Israel, they have to do right to left.
Right, right, right. But basically, this kind of sequencing is just, it's only used in reading.
That's right.
Okay, so another one.
When they have done studies of eye movements, when you scan a picture, it's never in what, it looks like a wild array of scanning.
Sure.
Because pictures are scanned totally differently from print.
Right, and I would suppose if we go back to where we learned some of our skills of surviving in the forest or surviving in the plains or surviving in the desert, it was not left to right. It was pretty random, probably.
Yeah.
Okay. So another skill.
Well, I'll mention one physical skill very briefly because it's a really important one, and that's handwriting. Now, one of the years and years ago, there was tremendous emphasis on handwriting, and it actually worked. But when the progressive education movement came in, they said, came in with the motto, drill is kill. And they said, stop all this drill and let the children figure out how to write on their own, and they'll be guiding themselves, and it'll be much better. So what has happened is that in the United States today, almost no classroom systematically teaches handwriting. If they do, it is to a whole class, it occupies no more than 5 minutes a day.
Oh, my God.
So
and we wonder why.
I
can remember doing the Palmer method, right? And of course, I went to Catholic school. Progressives need not apply.
It's funny. If I see a child today with a good handwriting, I'll say to their parent, is he in Catholic school? They say, yes, because they still do it there.
Okay.
But the other thing is, to the degree that it is thought about, it goes against what is necessary. So, for example, the first thing children are shown to copy, if they're asked to do that, is capital letters. They say capital letters are easier than lowercase. So what ends up is, so I say to people a page of text, and I say, how many capital letters do you see?
Oh.
It's much lower than 1%. So I say, so you're teaching the children to write with a different system than they're going to read. You've created a totally unnecessary obstacle here. And if you start with lowercase letters and you start with single line letters like C and O and so, it's much easier. And again, we can get children writing very well within 4 to 6 weeks. And then again, it's maintained throughout. If you establish it well and early, it really moves beautifully.
One thing I heard in that, Marianne, was that you ask sort of these questions that it appears most people aren't asking, which is, you know, let me see, there's capitals, and there's, it's funny, it reminds me of the press where they go, well, there's 5,000 scientists who say one thing and 5 who say the other, well, we better do balance, you know. They go, well, there's lots of capital, there's 26 capitals and 26, you know, non-capital letters. It doesn't matter which one we teach, and what you do is you say, but let's see how we use them.
Yes.
Talk about the little words or the no-content words.
Well, if we leave the physical skills and we move into the language skills, there are 4 main areas of language that is acknowledged by linguists. Reading people don't think in those terms. So the first area is phonology, which is sounds. I won't go into that right now.
But that's phonics, right?
They touch on it. They don't really handle it well. Then you've got semantics, which are your concepts. And the third area is the area called syntax. Syntax is the grammar of the language. And in different languages work differently. But in English, a very key component to sentences are what are called the little words or the non-content words. They're called non-content because you can't point to them. Like you can say a door, and that you can see it, or he's sitting, you can see it. But a word like the, or is, or was, or did, or how, they don't have any referent. So people say they're contentless. Now, the other thing that's really interesting is that most of these words don't follow the quotes, phonics rules of English. So they're taught as exceptions. In many schools, they're taught as bandits to make it exciting for the children. So what happens is that the children, because you see, if you took a word like he, it would be he, if you use phonics rules.
Right.
And if you took a word like was, it would be was. And of would be God knows what, uff, and so on. So they're taught as very little teaching time, and they're taught as exceptions. And they basically are told, the children are told these are really unimportant. They're not really part of the important thing. The important thing is sounding out.
Right, Dick and Jane and Cat and Hat are
exactly.
What's important, right?
And what's interesting and totally ignored is the fact that these words occupy approximately 60% of any page of text you'll ever see in your life. So they are actually the backbone of the language. And if you look at any sentence, for example, the boy was in the car. The was in the. So the majority of words that are used, that are expressed, are non-content words. Now, the other thing is they are very critical to meaning.
Of course.
No one knows how to teach them. So it gets very different if you say she walked the dog and she walked to the dog. And so what happens is there's nothing, literally almost nothing done in regular teaching, which gets the children to be aware of these words, and to realize their meaning. And one of the things that's really important is when you go from the worksheets that the children constantly have to deal with, where it's all sounding out, and you go to a real text, every other word or more is going to be a non-content word. They're never ready for it. So they're falling. It's like being in a minefield where every other word you're falling because those are the words you've never been trained to deal with. It's also known that, and I did some of that research a long time ago, but there are others who've done it, that those words are the hardest for children who have reading problems. So the very words that they need most help on, they were never given help on. And I've made them a central part of the program.
Right. So in other words, we've got here a couple of differences between your approach and conventional approaches.
Yes.
One is that you examine the fact that left-to-right sequencing is not normal.
Yeah.
So we better see if people have that skill, and if they don't, we better develop it. You look and you see that capitals are used much less than
lowercase.
So let's teach some lowercase.
Yes.
They're going to be more useful. You see that little words, content-less words, are actually essential to comprehension and syntax,
yes,
and make up 50%, so you teach those where they're usually ignored. I mean, this sounds like common sense.
That's right. And someone said, really good ideas are always common sense. It's like, how did someone not think of this sooner? And that almost makes me feel better because it shows me I'm right. I'm on the right track. Because lots of times that's what people say. It's so obvious. And it is when you think about it.
Yeah, and but it sounds like is that they didn't ask, the people who put together most of the conventional ways of teaching didn't ask some of those. The reason that I just went through that list of things is they didn't ask simple questions. How many capitals? How many lowercase? How many, you know, contentless mm-hmm. words? How many words of content? And once you ask it, it seems like if you... Obviously, what makes learning fun and makes learning exciting is success,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
You've got it. Exactly.
And so if you can give them success, little victories, now you've got motivation, you feel like you're closer to the reward. And what you were pointing out, I think, is that if they've mastered a bunch of hat, cat, you know, top, pot kind of stuff,
yeah,
but then they go into a page of reading where every other word they've never seen before, these little words, now suddenly they were just having a good week of mastering some phonics, and now they're back in Frustrationville.
Exactly. The success element is enormous. And one of the things in the program is not only the content, but the way it's been designed to minimize error and then to give techniques to overcome error. And one of the interesting things is if you look at almost any book on teaching reading or any program, they never consider the issue of error, which you've pointed out. It's really important. So what happens is when they say do this with the child, but very often do this doesn't work. And so once this happens, you get the child so demoralized. And that's a very important issue, is not only what you present, but to present it to make sure that you will not get high rates of error.
Okay. Marion Blank, I'm going to give you about a minute, minute and a half. What's the big message here, and where can listeners, if they're excited about this or they're frustrated with everything else, where can they learn more?
Well, they certainly can go to my website, phonicsplus5.com. The book really explains the whole system, the reading remedy. And I think the message is, first of all, that you really can teach reading well. You can teach it early. I often start children at 4.5 to 5 years of age so that when they go to school, they're reading effectively, because the worst thing for a child is to get into a class and then look around and some kids are learning and he isn't, and it's overwhelming.
Well, it's that same thing about success and failure.
That's right.
Success breeds success, failure breeds failure.
Exactly. So it really is possible to do very effective reading where the kids love the sense of mastery that they get. And so the idea is to get these ideas across as fast as possible.
If someone doesn't have access to the web, mm-hmm. they can't go to phonicsplus5.com, or
mm-hmm.
they don't have the money
mm-hmm.
or the time, what would you tell a parent if they didn't have your program but they wanted their kid to read?
One of the reasons I designed the book the way I did is that parents who were interested could design the materials themselves. I've given them all
okay.
the information. The other thing is that if they're in a regular system, one clue
okay.
that I would say is don't ever ask your child to sound it out. Just tell them the word and prevent the error.
We've been speaking with Marion Blank. Her book is The Reading Remedy, and her site is phonicsplus5. That's one word, phonicsplus5.com. Thank you, Marion, and keep up the good work.